Now then, while you were anxious to know who would rule the whole world after you, God, wishing as you slept to reveal to you all who would reign, showed you a dream of this kind. You seemed to see a great statue standing, whose head was made of gold, whose shoulders and arms were of silver, whose belly and thighs were of bronze, and whose legs and feet were of iron. Then a stone broke off from a mountain, fell upon the statue, threw it down, and shattered it, leaving no part of it whole, so that the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the iron were reduced finer than flour, and, a violent wind rising, these were caught up by its force and scattered abroad, while the stone grew so great that it seemed to fill the whole earth. This, then, is the dream you saw, and its interpretation is as follows. The golden head signifies you and the kings of Babylon before you. The arms and shoulders signify that your empire will be brought down by two kings. Their power in turn another will overthrow, one clad in bronze coming from the west, and this power yet another will end, one like iron, and this one will prevail over all because of the nature of iron, for it is harder than gold, silver, or bronze. Daniel also explained to the king the meaning of the stone, but it did not seem right to me to relate this, since my task is to record what is past and what has already happened, not what is to come. If, however, anyone is eager for such precision and cannot resist inquiring further, wishing to learn also what is still uncertain about the future, let him take the trouble to read the book of Daniel. He will find it among the sacred writings. King Nebuchadnezzar, having heard this and recognized the dream, was astonished at Daniel's nature, and falling on his face, paid homage to Daniel in the manner in which men worship God. He even ordered that sacrifice be offered to him as to a god, and moreover, giving him the name of his own god, he made him governor over the whole kingdom, along with his kinsmen, the very men who, through envy and malice, came into danger through offending the king, for the following reason. The king had made a golden statue 60 cubits in height and 6 in breadth, and having set it up in the great plain of Babylon and being about to consecrate it, he summoned the leading men from every land over which he ruled, and instructed them first that, whenever they heard the sound of the trumpet, they should fall down and worship the statue, and he threatened that those who did not do so would be thrown into a furnace of fire. So when all, upon hearing the trumpet sound, fell down and worshiped the statue, Daniel's kinsmen alone, they say, refused to do this, unwilling to transgress their ancestral laws. And these, once convicted, were immediately thrown into the fire, but by divine providence were saved and escaped death against all expectation. But in my judgment, the reason was this. Since they had done no wrong, when they were thrown into it, the fire did not touch them, and its burning power was too weak, since the children of God had bodies too strong for it to consume by its heat. This event convinced the king that they were righteous men beloved of God, and for this reason they continued afterward to be honored by him with every distinction. A little while later, the king again saw, in his sleep, another vision, that he would be cast out of his kingdom and would live among wild beasts, and that after spending 7 years in this way in the wilderness, he would receive his kingdom back again. Having seen this dream, he again summoned the magicians and asked them to interpret it and tell him what it signified. None of the others was able to discover the meaning of the dream or explain it to the king, but Daniel alone both interpreted it, and it happened just as he had foretold. For after spending the appointed time in the wilderness, with no one daring to seize power during the 7 years, he prayed to God to receive back his kingdom and return to it. Let no one blame me for reporting each of these matters just as I have found them written. Through the written record, exactly as I find it set down in the ancient books. Indeed, right at the beginning of my history, I guarded myself in advance against anyone who might raise questions or complaints about these matters, by stating that I intended only to translate the Hebrew books into the Greek language and to report their contents, undertaking neither to add anything of my own to the facts nor to take anything away. King Nebuchadnezzar, after reigning 43 years, died, a vigorous man who had proved more fortunate than the kings before him. Berossus, too, recalls his achievements in the third book of his History of Chaldea, where he writes as follows. His father Nebuchadnezzar, on hearing that the satrap he had appointed over Egypt and the region of Seal Syria and Phoenicia had revolted from him, and being unable to bear the hardship of campaigning himself, put a portion of his forces under the command of his son Nebuchadnezzar, who was still a young man, and sent him against the rebel. Nebuchadnezzar engaged the rebel in battle, defeated him, and brought the territory back under his own rule as part of that same dominion. At that very time, it happened that his father Nebuchadnezzar fell ill and died in the city of Babylon, having reigned 21 years. When not long afterward, the son learned of his father's death, he settled affairs in Egypt and the rest of the country, and put certain of his friends in charge of bringing the Jewish, Phoenician, and Syrian captives, along with the peoples from Egypt, back to Babylonia, together with the heaviest part of the army and the remaining spoils, while he himself set out with a small escort through the desert and made his way to Babylon. There he found affairs being administered by the Chaldeans and the kingdom preserved by the best man among them. And having taken possession of his father's entire realm, he arranged for the captives who arrived to be settled as colonies in the most suitable places in Babylonia, while he himself, from the spoils of the war, lavishly adorned both the Temple of Bel and the rest of the shrines, and generously endowed the city that already existed from the beginning as well as building others. And to make it impossible for those besieging the city ever again to turn the river against it and use it in constructing their siege works, he surrounded the inner city with three circuits of walls and the outer part with three more, built of baked brick. Having fortified the city impressively and adorned its gates in a manner befitting a sacred place, he built, adjoining his father's palace, a second palace, whose height and general magnificence it would perhaps be excessive to describe in detail, except to say that these great and towering works were completed in only 15 days. In this palace, he raised up stone terraces, giving them the appearance of mountains, and by planting them with every kind of tree, he created and built what is called the Hanging Garden, because his wife longed for the mountain scenery of her own country, having been raised in the region of Media. Megasthenes, too, mentions these works in the fourth book of his Indica, where he attempts to show that this king surpassed Heracles in courage and in the scale of his achievements, saying that he conquered a great part of Libya and Iberia. Diocles as well mentions this king in the second book of his Persian history, as does Philostratus in his History of India and Phoenicia, saying that this king besieged Tyre for 13 years, at a time when Ithabel was reigning over Tyre. Such, then, are the things reported about this king by all the various authors. After the death of Nebuchadnezzar, his son Evil-Merodach succeeded to the kingdom. He immediately released Jeconiah, king of Jerusalem, from his chains, kept him among his closest friends, gave him many gifts, and set him above the other kings residing in Babylonia. For his father had not kept faith with Jeconiah, who had voluntarily surrendered himself, along with his wives, his children, and his whole family for the sake of his homeland, so that the city might not be razed after being taken by siege, as we have already related. When Evil-Merodach died, after reigning 18 years, his son Nergalesar succeeded to the throne, and after holding it for 40 years, he too ended his life. After him, the succession passed to his son Labashi-Marduk, and after he had reigned a total of only 9 months, upon his death the throne passed to the man called Belshazzar, known among the Babylonians as Nabonidus. Cyrus, king of the Persians, and Darius the Mede marched against him. And while the people of Babylon were under siege, an extraordinary and astonishing sight occurred. The king was reclining at dinner, drinking in a great hall built for royal banquets, in the company of his concubines and his friends. It occurred to him to have brought from his own temple the sacred vessels of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried off as plunder from Jerusalem, but had never made use of, having simply deposited them in his temple. Belshazzar, however, driven by his own recklessness to make use of them, was in the middle of drinking and blaspheming God when he saw a hand come forth out of the wall and begin writing certain letters upon it. Thrown into confusion by the sight, he summoned the magicians and the Chaldeans, the whole class of men in Babylon capable of interpreting signs and dreams, so that they might explain to him what had been written. But when the magicians proved unable to discover anything or to say they understood it, the king, in his distress and in the depth of his grief over so extraordinary an event, issued a proclamation throughout the whole country promising to give to whoever could make plain the writing, and the meaning it conveyed a golden collar to wear about his neck, purple robes like those worn by the kings of the Chaldeans, and a third part of his own kingdom. When this proclamation was issued, the magicians redoubled their efforts and competed with one another to discover the meaning of the writing, yet were no more successful than before. Seeing the king despondent over this, his grandmother began to encourage him, saying that there was a certain captive from Judea, brought from there by Nebuchadnezzar when he sacked Jerusalem, named Daniel, a wise man, skilled at discovering things beyond human reach and known only to God, who, when no one else had been able to tell Nebuchadnezzar what he wanted to know, had brought to light the things he sought. She urged, therefore, that he send for the man and inquire of him about the writing, and condemn the ignorance of those who had failed to find its meaning, however grim what God was signifying might prove to be. On hearing this, Belshazzar summoned Daniel, and after conversing with him and learning about him and his wisdom, that a divine spirit was present in him, and that he alone was fully capable of discovering what did not occur to the minds of others, he asked him to tell him what had been written and to reveal its meaning. For if he did this, he would give him a purple robe to wear, a golden collar about his neck, and a third part of his own kingdom as an honor and reward for his wisdom, so that through these gifts he might become the most conspicuous of men in the eyes of all who saw him and asked the reason he had received them. But Daniel asked that he keep his gifts for himself, for wisdom and what is divine, he said, cannot be bought and ought to benefit those in need without payment. He would, however, reveal to him the meaning of the writing, which foretold the ruin of his life, because he had not learned piety even from the punishments by which his ancestor had been chastised for his outrages against God, nor had he refrained from devising anything beyond what belongs to human nature. On the contrary, he said, even after Nebuchadnezzar was driven to live among the beasts because of his impieties, and after many supplications and entreaties was shown mercy and restored to human life and to his kingdom, and even though because of this he sang hymns to God as one who possesses all power and watches over mankind, right up until his death, you yourself have forgotten all this, and you have blasphemed the divine many times over. And you have used his sacred vessels to serve wine to your concubines. God, seeing this, has grown angry with you, and through this writing he foretells the kind of end to which you must come. What the writing declares is this, M-E-N-E, this word, he said, in the Greek tongue signifies a number, meaning that God has numbered the time of your life and of your reign, and that only a little time remains to you. T-E-K-E-L, this signifies a weight. God, having weighed the time of your reign, declares that it is already sinking down. P-E-R-E-S, this too, in the Greek tongue, signifies a fraction. Therefore he will break your kingdom in pieces and divide it between the Medes and the Persians. When Daniel had explained to the king in this way the meaning of the writing on the wall, grief and calamity overtook Belshazzar, as one would expect given how harsh the message revealed to him had been. Yet he did not, on account of the evils he had been told of, withhold from the man who had prophesied them the gifts he had promised to give, but bestowed them all, reasoning that the circumstances under which they would be given were his own affair and a matter of necessity, and had nothing to do with the man who had made the prophecy, whom he judged, on the strength of what had been agreed, to be a good and just man, even though what was to come was grim. So he judged rightly. Not long afterward he himself was captured, and the city was taken, when Cyrus, king of the Persians, marched against him. For it was under Belshazzar that the fall of Babylon took place, after he had reigned 17 years. Such, then, is the end that we have learned befell the descendants of King Nebuchadnezzar. As for Darius, who together with his kinsman Cyrus put an end to the Babylonian Empire, he was 62 years old when he took Babylon. He was the son of Astyages, though he was known among the Greeks by a different name. He took Daniel the prophet with him to Media, granting him every honor and keeping him at his side. For Daniel was one of the 3 governors whom he set over the 360 satrapies, for that was the number Darius established for the empire. Now Daniel, holding such honor and enjoying such conspicuous favor with Darius, and being the one man Darius trusted above all others in every matter, as having the divine spirit within him, became, in being so honored, an object of envy. For those who see others held in greater honor than themselves by kings are always inclined to malice. Those who resented his high standing with Darius sought some occasion for slander and accusation against him, but he gave them no grounds whatever. For being above money and disdaining every kind of profit, he considered it utterly shameful to accept anything even when it might rightly have been given him to take, and so he offered those who envied him no pretext for any charge against him. Since they had nothing they could report to the king that would harm him in the honor he enjoyed from him, through shame or slander, they sought some other way to remove him from their path. Observing, then, that Daniel prayed to God 3 times a day, they concluded they had found the pretext by which they would destroy him. They went to Darius and reported to him that it had seemed good to his satraps and governors that for 30 days the populace should be forbidden to petition or pray to anyone, whether man or God, other than himself, and that whoever transgressed this decree should be condemned to be thrown into the lion's den to perish. The king, not perceiving their treachery and never suspecting that this scheme had been devised against Daniel, said he was pleased with what they had decided, and promising to ratify their proposal, published an edict making known to the people what the satraps had resolved. All the rest, taking care not to transgress what had been commanded, kept quiet. But Daniel gave not the slightest thought to any of it, and, as was his custom, stood and prayed to God in full view of everyone. The satraps, once the pretext they had been eager to seize upon against Daniel presented itself, went at once to the king and accused Daniel of being the only one to have transgressed the decree. For none of the others, they said, had dared to pray to their gods, not out of piety, but out of caution and self-preservation prompted by their envy. Supposing that Darius was acting out of an even greater favor toward Daniel than they had expected, so that he would readily grant him pardon even for defying his own commands, and being jealous of Daniel precisely on this account, they would not relent toward any gentler course, but insisted that he be thrown, according to the law, into the lion's den. Darius, hoping that the divine power would rescue Daniel, and that he would suffer no harm from the beasts, told him to bear what was happening with good courage. And once Daniel had been cast into the den, Darius sealed with his own seal the stone that lay across the opening in place of a door, and withdrew. Through the whole night he neither ate nor slept, but remained in anguish over Daniel. And at daybreak he rose, went to the den, and finding the seal intact with which he had marked the stone before leaving it, opened it, and cried out, calling to Daniel and asking whether he was safe. When Daniel answered the king and said that he had suffered no harm, Darius ordered him drawn up out of the den of beasts. His enemies, seeing that Daniel had suffered no harm, refused to attribute it to the divine and to God's providence over him, but claimed instead, thinking the lions had eaten their fill and so had not touched or approached Daniel, that this was the reason, and they said as much to the king. The king, detesting them for their wickedness, ordered a great quantity of meat thrown to the lions, and once they were satisfied, he commanded that Daniel's enemies be thrown into the den, so that he might learn whether it was because they were full that the lions would not go near them. It became clear to Darius, once the satraps had been thrown to the beasts, that it was the divine power that had saved Daniel. For the lions spared none of them, but tore them all to pieces, as though they were ravenously hungry and starved for food. What provoked them was not hunger, I think, since only a little before they had been gorged with abundant meat, but rather the wickedness of the men, which was evident even to these unreasoning creatures, for the sake of a punishment that came about by the choice of God. Once those who had plotted against Daniel had perished in this way, King Darius sent word throughout the whole country praising the God whom Daniel worships, and declaring that he alone true and the only one who holds power over all things. He also held Daniel in the highest honor, appointing him first among his friends. Daniel, so distinguished and so celebrated for his reputation as one beloved of God, built at Ecbatana in Media a fortress, a most handsome piece of work and wonderfully constructed, which survives and is preserved to this day, and to those who see it looks as if it had just been built and finished on the very day someone happens to be viewing it, so fresh and undiminished is its beauty, in no way aged by so much time. For buildings suffer the same fate as men. They grow gray and lose their strength under the years, and their beauty withers. But in this fortress, they bury the kings of the Medes and the Persians and the Parthians even to this day. And the man entrusted with its care is a Jewish priest, and this remains the practice down to the present day. It is worth relating also what is most remarkable about this man, something one would marvel at on hearing it. For he was granted, as few men ever have been, both honor and glory from kings and from the people throughout his lifetime, and after his death he holds an everlasting memory. For the books he wrote and left behind are read among us still today, and from them we are convinced that Daniel spoke with God. For he did not simply go on prophesying future events, as the other prophets also did, but he even fixed the time at which these things would come to pass. And whereas the other prophets, when they foretold the harsher things, were resented by kings and people for it, Daniel was a prophet of good things to them, so that from the favorable character of his predictions, he drew goodwill from everyone, while from their fulfillment he won, among the masses, both credit for truthfulness and a reputation for something divine besides. And in what he left in writing, he made clear to us that the exactness and unfailing accuracy of his prophecy can be trusted. For he says that when he was at Susa, the capital of Persia, and had gone out to the plain with his companions, an earthquake and a sudden convulsion of the earth occurred, and he was left alone, his friends having fled. He fell upon his face, thrown down onto his two hands, and then someone touched him and, as he lay there, told him to rise and to see what would happen to his countrymen after many generations. When he had risen, a great ram was shown to him, one that had sprouted many horns, the last of which was taller than the rest. Then, looking toward the west, he saw a he-goat carried through the air from that direction, which clashed with the ram and, striking with its horns, knocked it to the ground twice and trampled it. Then he saw the goat put forth from its forehead a very great horn, which, once it was broken off, gave rise to four horns turned toward each of the four winds. And from these he wrote that another, smaller horn also arose, which, as it grew, the God who was showing him these things told him would make war on his nation and destroy the city by force, and would throw into confusion the affairs of the temple and prevent the sacrifices from being offered for a period of 1,296 days. These things Daniel wrote that he saw in the plain at Susa, and God made clear to him the meaning of the vision as follows. The ram, he said, signified the kingdoms of the Medes and Persians, and the horns the kings who were to reign, and the last horn signified the last king, for this one would surpass all the others in wealth and glory. The goat signified that a certain king would arise from among the Greeks, who, joining battle with the Persian, would defeat him twice in battle and take over the whole empire. The great horn on the goat's forehead signified the first king, and the sprouting of the four horns after that one had fallen off, and their turning toward the four regions of the earth signified that his successors would appear after the first king's death, each in one of these regions, and that the kingdom would be divided among them, though these were neither his sons nor his kinsmen, and that they would rule the inhabited world for many years. And from among these, he said, there would arise a certain king who would make war upon the nation and its laws, would take away their constitution based on these laws, would plunder the temple, and would prevent the sacrifices from being carried out for 3 years. And indeed these very things our nation suffered at the hands of Antiochus Epiphanes, just as Daniel had seen and had written down many years beforehand that they would happen. In the same way, Daniel also wrote concerning the empire of the Romans, and that it would be laid waste by them. All these things, once God had shown them to him, he wrote down and left behind, so that those who read them and observe how events turn out marvel at the honor Daniel received from God, and find from these very things that the Epicureans have gone astray, who cast providence out of life and refuse to hold that God oversees the affairs of the world, or that the universe is governed for its own preservation by that blessed and imperishable being, but say instead that the world, without a guide and without anyone caring for it, is carried along by chance. But if the world were indeed unsteered in this way, then just as we see ships without pilots sunk by the winds, or chariots overturned when they have no one driving them, it too would long since have been shattered by uncontrolled disaster and destroyed and ruined. It seems to me, then, that those who declare that God exercises no providence at all over human affairs go badly astray from the true opinion, in the light of what was foretold by Daniel. For if the world were governed by mere chance, we would not have seen everything come to pass in accordance with his prophecy. As for myself, I have written of these matters just as I found them and read them. But if anyone wishes to judge them differently, let him hold his differing opinion without reproach from me.